Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Everything starts with a design. Art, fashion, architecture, just about everything. Wouldn't you like to know more about what inspired the designer and why they designed something as they did? Welcome to Dishing the Dirt on Design with hosts Ann Asher and Eleanor Schrader Schappa. We'll speak to some of the most renowned names in the field of design, along with Ann and Eleanor's comments and flair. Let's get started. Here's Ann and Eleanor.
Hello, everyone. I'm Eleanor Schrader Schappa, and welcome to Dishing the Dirt on Design, where we tell the stories behind the stories. My co-host, Ann Asher, is still off having fun without me, but she'll be back soon. One of the themes of our radio broadcast has been glamour and glamorous design. And what could be more glamorous than Hollywood? So today I thought I'd tell you the story of how Hollywood began, as well as the stories of the people who came here and the stories of the houses they lived in. And as you're listening to this talk, you might view some images that I've posted for you on our Facebook page. Go to www.facebook.com/dishingthedirtondesign for images that will bring to life some of the beautiful homes that I'm going to tell you about. So let's begin the story. Before Hollywood became the world's entertainment mecca, it resembled other West frontiers, a landscape of farmers, cowboys, prospectors, bandits, and mostly undeveloped land. All the land north of Sunset Boulevard, for example, was considered useless for anything but grazing. With more and more Easterners drawn by the promise of sunny skies and mild, dry weather, the area's bedrock industry, real estate, soon kicked into high gear. Subdivisions begat more subdivisions, and by the end of the 19th century, Hollywood was taking on the contours of a recognizable town. Thanks to Dida Wilcox, it also had a name. In 1887, Mrs. Wilcox, wife of town founder Harvey Wilcox, met a woman on a train trip who referred to her Florida summer home, Hollywood. She was so struck by the name that she suggested it to her husband, Mr. Wilcox, and the rest is history. All was quiet until 1907, when a small Chicago film company, the Selig Polyscope Company, came westward to complete a shoot utilizing ocean scenes for Monte Cristo. In 1910, the Biograph Company, with D.W. Griffith as their producer, traveled from New York to Los Angeles to shoot the film Ramona in authentic locations, as well as to determine the suitability of the West Coast as a place for a permanent studio. A small facility was set up at Washington Street and Grand Avenue, where the L.A. Convention Center now stands. Then Griffith and his players decided to go a little north to Hollywood land, and they made the film called In Old California. By 1912, word of Hollywood's ideal film shooting climate and landscape spread, and at least 15 independent studios could be found shooting around town. Old barns were turned into sound stages, and Hollywood's quiet time was over. Now, it wasn't just sunny skies that spurred the mass film migration to Hollywood. In 1897, famous inventor and early movie mogul Thomas Edison began suing rival producers who were utilizing filmmaking projection devices based, he felt, on his kinetoscope technology. Many of these movie pirates fled from New Jersey, which was the home of the Edison Company and the original movie capital, first to Cuba and then to California for good. In 1915, America was officially film craze, and Hollywood was shaping into the glamorous, sometimes surreal landscape we've come to know and love or hate. Hopeful actors and actresses filled the streets, dazzled by a new American dream, film stardom. Studios, meanwhile, sprung up like wildfires and engaged in a cutthroat battle for survival. As the industry matured, many of these independent companies merged, forming the big studios that would shape and control the industry moving forward. By 1920, 40 million Americans were going to the movies each week. As the industry blossomed, Hollywood strove to keep pace physically. Los Angeles history buffs and fans of the movie Chinatown know the key to the area's explosive development during the early 20th century was the Owens Valley Aqueduct System. That was spearheaded by William Mulholland, who was the head engineer of the Municipal Water Department, and it was initially completed in 1913. During the 1920s, a whimsical skyline of movie-set-inspired hotels and apartments rose along the big boulevards. The more prestigious addresses, including the opulent Garden Court Apartments, Chateau Elysee, and Garden of Allah Villas, were imbued with the glamour of the stars that called them home. And the rise of the film aristocracy also meant suave new restaurants and nightclubs up and down Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard. Extravagant movie palaces completed the iconic Hollywood landscape. So Hollywood, which by now represented not just a city, but also an industry, a lifestyle, and increasingly an aspiration, was officially crowned when the Hollywood Land sign was erected in 1923. And that sign was built by Los Angeles Times publisher Harry Chandler to promote his upscale real estate development, Hollywood Land Estates. And the sign on Mount Lee soon took on the role of a giant marquee for a city that was constantly announcing its own gala premiere. Costing $21,000. The sign consisted of 13 letters that were 50 feet high and 30 feet wide, made of sheet metal, pipe, wire, telephone poles, and 4,000 flashing 40-watt light bulbs. In 1949, the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce restored the sign after years of neglect and removed the word land. So now we just have Hollywood on our big sign. So along with the fantasy life of the movies, Los Angeles is a haven of fantasy architecture. Dubbed Romantic Revivals, consisting primarily of Spanish Colonial Revival, English Tudor Revival, French Normandy, and Mediterranean styles. These were the styles approved for the Hollywood Land development. Spanish Colonial Revival is particularly well suited to Los Angeles because of our Spanish, Mexican, and Native American heritage. And I want to segue a little bit into this heritage so that you understand why Southern California has this particular look about it. So Spanish occupation of California began in 1769 when an expedition led by Father Junipero Serra and Captain Gaspar de Portola moved through the area now known as Los Angeles, through the area of Elysian Park, kind of where our Dodger Stadium is, and they camped overnight by a river. Father Serra had been sent by Spain to establish a chain of 21 missions on a 650-mile stretch of California called El Camino Real, or the King's Highway, in this area of California. And each mission was meant to be one day's ride from the next. And so coming up through Sonora, Mexico, their mission was to establish a series of missions between what is now known as San Diego and San Francisco. Father Juan Crespi, the diarist who accompanied the group, saw the location as having all the requirements necessary for a large settlement, primarily fertile soil and availability of water. And he wrote in his diary, "After traveling about a league and a half through a pass between low hills, we entered a very spacious valley, well grown with cottonwoods and alders, among which ran a beautiful river from north-northwest, and then doubling the point of a steep hill, it went on afterward to the south. As soon as we arrived, about 8 heathens," those were his words, the Native Americans, "from a good village came to visit us. They live in this delightful place among the trees on the river. And some members of the expedition noted some bubbling tar pits a few miles from this point. And during their brief stay, there had been 3 small earthquakes." So things don't really change that much, do they? And so he named the river El Río de Nuestra Señora de Los Ángeles de Porciúncula, meaning the River of Our Lady, the Queen of Angels of the Little Portion. And hence, the name of our city was El Pueblo de la Reina de Los Ángeles, established in 1781. And so, when we come back, I will tell you how the land speculators seized upon these opportunities, and we'll be back in a few minutes with Dishing the Dirt on Design.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com. Make your dreams come true. When you want the very best excellence and elegance in interior design, contact Ann Asher, named one of the world's top 40 interior designers by the Robb Report. Visit her website at www.annasherinteriors.com or send an email to info@annasherinteriors.com.
Ready to chat about your favorite soap operas? The Daytime Discussion is here with Dan J. Kroll and Soap Central Live. For the past 15 years, Dan has been dishing and discussing on SoapCentral.com. And now he's taking the talk to the airwaves of the Voice America Variety Channel. You'll go behind the scenes with the biggest stars of daytime, along with guest commentary from the Soap Central columnists. And we'll take your questions and comments during our live show. Soap Central Live, every Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
Tune in to The Hoffman Connection for inspiration, a life of passion and purpose. Hosts Raz Ingrassi and Ed McClune will bring you ways to remove the blocks in your life that are holding you back. Along with their guest experts, Raz and Ed will use their experience and expertise to help you learn to get closer to what matters to you most. And by doing so, improve your life and the lives of others. The Hoffman Connection can be heard live every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
News. Opinion. Your voice counts. Call toll-free 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to Dishing the Dirt on Design with Ann Asher and Eleanor Schrader Schappa. For more information about our program, please visit dishingthedirtondesign.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Dishing the Dirt on Design, and we're continuing the story of the glamour of old Hollywood. So beginning in the late 1860s, land speculators began advertising to attract subdivision buyers. In the 1870s, the railways began touting the attractions of Los Angeles to boost passenger traffic, the freight business, and the sale of railroad-owned land. A developing business community also hoped to spur the growth of a community of consumers. These interests chose advertising to emphasize the different and better aspects of climate, agricultural potential, opportunities for easy, wealth, health, vacation destinations, and romance. This promotional literature reflected idealized views of California's past that would come to be known collectively as the Mission Myth. Ironically, the book perhaps most responsible for romanticizing the region's early days was written by an East Coast writer, Helen Hunt Jackson, who had arrived in California in the late 1870s. She was appalled by the way in which Native Americans had been treated and wrote a report to the government. Her report was ignored, so she decided to write a popular novel. Published in 1884, Ramona recounted the tragic love between Ramona, a woman of mixed heritage, and a Native American man named Alessandro, but the novel had an effect quite different from what its author had hoped, and Alessandro's death at the hand of a bigoted white settler was intended to entice the public into reading a book with a serious social message. Instead, Ramona's sentimental style ended up fostering a romantic perception of life on the missions and ranchos of old California. In 1912, the Universal Film Company leased former rancho lands, the Taylor Horse Ranch in North Hollywood, and moved production to the newly created Universal City Studios. And the studio was in the Spanish Mission style, fronting Lancashire Boulevard. Rudolph Valentino's first home in Whitley Heights exemplifies the Spanish Colonial Revival style. But sadly, it was demolished to make room for the Hollywood Freeway in 1951. Falcon Lair in Beverly Hills was to be Valentino's retreat from public life, his castle, and the palace to share with Natasha Rambova. But she divorced him shortly after he bought the property. He imported many Italian plants to turn it into more of an Italian villa. A two-story garage over what were the servants' quarters was added, along with stables for his blooded Arabian horses, Firefly, Yaki, Ramadan, and Haroon. A skilled horseman, he enjoyed rides outside his property until all the adoring fans became too much. And determined to enjoy his canters, he purchased the adjoining acreage, in essence, doubling the size of Falcon Lair and enjoying the use of extended bridle paths. After his death in 1926, Falcon Lair was sold off to pay his debts, and it was later purchased by Doris Duke in the early 1950s, and she is the one who renamed it Falcon's Lair. It was bulldozed in 2006. Only the outer gates and fence structure and garage area remain from Valentino's time. Buster Keaton's 1926 10,000 square foot Italianate villa has more than 20 rooms, secret passages, and hidden rooms. Along with a guest house, it was built on 5 landscaped acres that included a motorized trout stream and an aviary that encircled the property. Tom Mix lived next door, and Charlie Chaplin lived across the street. The property has been occupied by James and Pamela Mason, Marlena Dietrich, and Cary Grant. It cost $300,000 to build. And that was a financial stretch for Keaton, and almost as soon as he moved in, his luck began to change. His wife, Natalie Talmadge, who reportedly was spending $800 to $900 a week on her wardrobe, demanded a divorce. Talkies started supporting Silence, and Keaton began drinking and gambling heavily. He lost his production company in 1928, and to keep up with his mounting household bills, he was forced to work for the movie mill MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and relinquish all creative control of his work. By the early 1930s, the house had been sold to MGM dance team Fanchon and Marco. As styles changed, the house became a white elephant and fell into decline and disrepair through successive owners. It was later sold to Woolworth heiress Barbara Hutton and her husband Cary Grant, and in Hollywood circles also known as Cash and Cary, during their 1942 to 1945 marriage. And then in 1948, it was sold to British actor James Mason and his wife Pamela. Keaton later said, "I took a lot of pratfalls to build that dump." James Mason found numerous cans of rare Keaton films in the house in the 1950s, and the films were quickly transferred to safety film before the original cellulose nitrate prints further deteriorated. It was saved from demolition in 1998 by two developers who paid $5 million. There's a small enclosed veranda with its original checkerboard black and white tiles made of imported Venetian marble, which Keaton had put in because Rudolph Valentino had said, "There's nothing like tile for a tango." Valentino was a neighbor. Falcon's Lair was just up on Bella Drive. Cork floor coverings installed in a number of rooms by the Masons in the 1950s were pulled up to expose peg and groove hardwood floors beneath them. When a set of bookshelves were removed from a recessed wall in the game room, which had also served as Keaton's private theater, Keaton's original movie screen was hidden in a slot in the wall. Charlie Chaplin is the most famous resident associated with Moorcrest. Later, starting in 1925, Mary Astor, who had acted in Beau Brummel of 1924 and The Maltese Falcon 1941, lived there with her parents. And it was designed by Marie Rusak Hotchner as part of a theosophist colony called Crotona. Mary Astor hated Moorcrest decor, which she called unfortunate. The red lotus keyhole windows and central arched window are clearly seen in the background of the photo that I posted for you on Facebook. And her parents held her a virtual prisoner in the house while living off her money. And at 19, she climbed from her second floor bedroom window and escaped to a hotel in Hollywood. Her father put Moorcrest up for auction in the early 1930s, hoping to get more than the $80,000 he had been offered for it. It went for $25,000. Now let's talk about Pickfair, the home of Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks. In 1919, Douglas Fairbanks purchased an old hunting lodge, renovated it in 1920, and moved in with his new bride, Mary. The home had 42 rooms. It was considered the White House of Beverly Hills, where many international dignitaries, from presidents to princes, came to visit. Douglas did not drink, and so many guests at Pickfair were surprised, and probably dismayed, to find no wine at the dinner table. After dinner and a movie, Ovaltine was served. After they divorced, Mary Pickford married Buddy Rogers, a man 12 years her junior, in 1937, and they lived at Pickfair until Pickford's death in 1979. Now, Fairbanks wanted to own a period bar stemming from his appreciation of Western art. He was an avid collector of paintings by Frederick Remington and Charles Russell and sought to create the proper environment for displaying them. It was Mary who realized her husband's dream by hiring two pioneers to scour California in search of a Western bar for the basement of Pick Fair. And their search ended at the Union Saloon in Old Town Auburn. The sumptuous bar was constructed of mahogany, about 16 feet in length, with three raised panels and four round columns with capitals. A brass rail ran across the top, and another served as a foot rail. The back bar was a symmetrical triumph with a large mirror bookended by cabinets with double doors of beveled and art glass. To ensure that no one missed the Western theme, a set of giant horns from a Texas Longhorn steer were mounted above the mirror. The bar was disassembled, crated, and shipped to Pick Fair, where it was installed in the basement. And according to a report in the December 31st, 1932 edition of the Placer Herald, Mary gave the much-traveled bar, which was said to have been originally shipped around Cape Horn, to Douglas as a Christmas gift that year. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more on Dishing the Dirt on Design.
Stay connected.
Sign up for our newsletter.
Go beyond your favorite Voice America shows. Visit iradioblog.com.
What would you do if you knew that you could not fail? The Dr. Pat Show with Dr. Pat Basile is a radio forum for some of the world's most influential people in the fields of health, wellness, and human potential. Dr. Pat brings together and introduces visionary scientists and futurists, environmentalists, educators, business leaders, inventors, filmmakers, authors, artists, mystics, and healers who inspire and support individual and collective growth and positive cultural shifts. This award-winning radio show empowers the listening community to be the change they want to see in the world. Tune in every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific for the Dr. Pat Show with Dr. Pat Basile, radio to thrive by.
Make your dreams come true. When you want the very best excellence and elegance in interior design, contact Ann Asher, named one of the world's top 40 interior designers by the Robb Report. Visit her website at www.annasherinteriors.com or send an email to info@annasherinteriors.com.
Very rarely does our news media spotlight some of the good things that are happening in our world. For more of these good stories and the people that are creating them, tune in to Bread for the Journey with Mariana Cacciatore. Whether these good acts stem from personal tragedy or just a desire to help out and make this a better world in which to live, you'll find inspiration in every week's program. Connect with those that are doing something great for a change. Listen for Bread for the Journey, Saturdays at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to Dishing the Dirt on Design with Ann Asher and Eleanor Schrader Schapa. For more information about our program, please visit dishingthedirtondesign.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Dishing the Dirt on Design. I'm Eleanor Schrader Schapa. My illustrious partner, Ann Asher, is off finding all sorts of new things for us to talk about, and so she'll be back with us soon. Today we're talking about the glamour of old Hollywood, and I'm telling you the stories of the architecture of some of the famous Hollywood icons. And let's continue on with La Loma de los Vientos, or Windy Hill, that was built for silent movie star William S. Hart. Some of his westerns were shot on and around a ranch in Newhall, California, and in 1925 he purchased the property. He commissioned architect Arthur Kelly to design a magnificent Spanish colonial revival style mansion, which he occupied in 1927. Hart filled his home with treasures reflecting his interest in the West, including Navajo textiles, Indian costumes, and Western paintings and sculptures. Windy Hill is open to the public, so I encourage you to go and visit as many of these homes as possible for you to develop your design eye. I know you enjoy looking at the images on our Facebook page, Dishing the Dirt on Design, but I invite you to join me when I go and visit these places. So just drop me a note or friend us on Facebook, and we'll be sure to let you know about some of our upcoming tours. When Theda Bera moved into her home on West Adams Boulevard, the house soon looked like one of her film sets. She packed the rooms with mummy cases, tiger skin rugs, crystal balls, and peacock feathers. Reporters were reluctant to visit her West Adams home alone for the fear that she would put them into a trance. The public could not get enough of that pale girl with her waist-length hair and haunting eyes. One of the fan magazines screamed across its headlines, "Is she the devil's handmaiden?" But as World War I drew to a close, the fascination with screen vamps faded and Theda's star descended as quickly as it rose. And so in 1919, she sold her Tudor mansion to screen sensation Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, and the West Adams residents breathed huge sighs of relief. If they only knew what was coming. By 1920, Fatty Arbuckle was the highest paid actor in the industry. He and his often estranged wife, actress Minta Durfee, went to work on the West Adams mansion, removing all traces of Theda Bera's ghoulish decor and sparing no expense. Sitting in the driveway of his home was his brand new $25,000 custom-made Rolls Royce, complete with a built-in toilet in the back seat. Arbuckle loved to have as much fun off-screen as he did in the movies, and he gave many parties at his new home. The guest list included such luminaries as Mack Sennett, Charlie Chaplin, the Talmadge sisters, and Mabel Normand. Arbuckle and his close friend Buster Keaton played many practical jokes on the studio heads who visited the West Adams house. At one party, Roscoe had Keaton playing a clumsy butler serving dinner to Paramount boss Adolf Zucker. Before Zucker knew what hit him, the turkey was off the silver tray and on his lap. Keaton then proceeded to calmly pour a pitcher of ice water into the lap of Paramount star Bebe Daniels. These raucous parties could be heard down the street at the Doheny Mansion on Chester Place, and Edward Doheny himself would walk over and pound on the door in frustration. Doheny offered to buy the home at top dollar, but Arbuckle had no intention of appeasing the oil magnate. And eventually Doheny did buy the mansion, and it's now a home to the Catholic Fathers of St. Vincent de Paul. Now, built in 1917, the actor Sessue Hayakawa's castle-styled Hollywood mansion at the corner of Franklin Avenue and Argyle Street became a landmark before being torn down in 1956. And he was known for his role on Bridge Over the River Kwai in 1957. Another beautiful house, Castillo de Lago, or Castle of the Lake in the Hollywood Hills, was originally built for oil explorer Patrick Longdon by Hollywood Land architect John Delario in 1926. In the late 1930s, Bugsy Siegel leased it. Gambling and nightlife followed, and so did the police, who staked out the situation from another house on the hill. If you look hard enough, you can see holes in the woodwork of the entry hall, which resulted from flying bullets. Well, Bugsy moved on in the 1940s, and Madonna bought it in 1993 for about $5 million. Jack Benny's house was built in a Georgian Revival style in 1937. His daughter Joan recalled that bold fans would ring the doorbell. Daddy was very friendly. He liked to chat with his fans, and we were always ready for them. We kept a supply of autographed 8x10 photos in the table in the hall. The Samuel Navarro house was originally meant for Navarro's personal secretary and companion, Louis Samuel. But the layout was expanded following Samuel's marriage in 1929. Samuel had embezzled money from Navarro and left him with $160 in the bank. However, Navarro decided not to press charges, but he did take over the home and, after extensive remodeling, moved onto the premises in 1932. Now, this is from a book called Beyond Paradise. On the outside, the house was an imposing structure. Located on a slope overlooking one of the Hollywood Hills canyons, it extended from its lower level on Valley Oak Road to its uppermost level and main gateway on Verde Oak. The outside walls were white concrete, partially shielded by patterned copper bands reminiscent of Mesoamerican temples, with a hollow block within the reinforced concrete that theoretically made the house earthquake-proof. From the gateway, a flight of Nile-green steps led down the terraced gardens to a blue-toned guest room immediately above the main house, which could be reached by a further staircase. With the assistance of MGM art director Cedric Gibbons, Navarro devised the modernistic interior, most of it furnished with pieces from the luxurious Bullocks Wilshire. The centrally located beige library posted a panoramic view of the canyons and was used as a drawing room for cocktails served on metal tables set before futuristic loungers. And this is all Art Deco. The dining room below, on a slightly lower level to one side of the library, had black walls which set off strands of dull silver chains. The dining table was of frosted metal with a black satin cover, an onyx stained tabletop, and aluminum legs. To the other side of the library was the bedroom, with pale green walls and dark green furniture that included a built-in dressing table and desk. At the end of the room, French doors opened to a swimming pool lined with Nile green tiles and surrounded by white concrete walls. The music room, where Navarro sang accompanied by friends at the piano, was underneath the dining room. Dull gold and bronze furniture and walls were covered by a rose brocade with a design akin to the copper motif found on the outside walls. This color scheme was contrasted by the whiteness of a polar bear rug and several light-colored pieces of woodwork. Adjoining the music room was a cocktail bar, and on the same floor, but reached through a separate entrance, were the servants' quarters and a passage leading down to the garage. "I had to get away from home to live alone in a house of my own," Navarro explained. "I had to cater to whims and notions of my own that would be impossible for others to live with. For instance, I am frequently seized with a sudden desire to play my piano when I am somewhere en route between my bath and my bedroom, clad as God made me. Now living alone, I can gratify this desire." Well, Navarro was able to enjoy his nude piano playing until late 1938, when he traded the house for several lots in the San Fernando Valley. Well, on the morning of October 31st, 1968, Navarro, who was then 69 years old, was found dead at his Laurel Canyon home in the Hollywood Hills. Two brothers, Paul and Tom Ferguson, were later accused and convicted of his murder. The night before his bloodied corpse was discovered, he had invited the two young men for a night of partying in his home. And the defense attorney, in reference to Navarro's numerous drunken driving episodes, which had begun at least as early as the 1940s, blamed the victim for his brutal death. For 40 years, the defense attorney told the jury, Navarro had been an accident walking around looking for a place to happen. So a very sad ending to a beautiful life that Navarro had in his beautiful home. We'll be back with more Dishing the Dirt on Design in just a few minutes.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
Get ready to talk about anything and everything. Listen for Life Matters with Kim Alberts. This is truly a roundtable, or whatever table, discussion. It's always the perfect place to sit with a cup of coffee and dish on the topics that matter most to you. Kim has an amazing background and is ready to talk about family, news, current events, and offer thought-provoking discussion and encouragement to get you through your day. Life Matters with Kim Alberts can be heard every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Make your dreams come true. When you want the very best excellence and elegance in interior design, contact Ann Asher, named one of the world's top 40 interior designers by the Robb Report. Visit her website at www.annasherinteriors.com or send an email to info@annasherinteriors.com.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to Dishing the Dirt on Design with Ann Asher and Eleanor Schrader Schapa. For more information about our program, please visit dishingthedirtondesign.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Dishing the Dirt on Design. I'm Eleanor Schrader Schapa, and I'm telling you some of the stories of the glamour of old Hollywood. We're talking about the movie stars and the houses in which they lived and the styles in which they were built and a bit about the interiors. And so let's continue with some of our stories. The home built for the movie actress Dolores Del Rio was created in the streamlined modern Art Deco style. It overlooks Santa Monica Canyon. It was designed by Cedric Gibbons. He was one of the original 36 founding members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and he oversaw the design of a very famous statue, the Academy Awards Oscar. That was designed in 1929, and it was a trophy for which Cedric Gibbons himself would be nominated 39 times, winning 11 times. Second only to Walt Disney, who won 26. The 10-acre estate built for Jack Warner by Roland Cote from 1926 to 1937 was designed in a neoclassical style. Jack Warner was the head of Warner Brothers Studios, and William Haynes designed the interiors in an English Georgian style. The home had originally been a Spanish-style house, but Cote rebuilt it in a Georgian Revival style when Warner married his second wife, Anne. When Anne Warner died in 1990, record executive David Geffen bought the property and the mansion's furnishings for $47.5 million. That broke national records at the time for a single-family residence. And if you go back and listen to our first broadcast, we had our guest Brett Parsons, historian extraordinaire on the history of Hollywood and Beverly Hills. He talked about the Jack Warner estate. And so if you go on our Facebook page, you will find some more information and images about the Jack Warner estate that Brett Parsons talked about. The architect Wallace Neff built houses for three of the Marx brothers in the same year. Neff recalled the comedian Groucho Marx's first visit to his office. He called Mr. Neff by his first name immediately, which was a big breach of etiquette in those days. Groucho said, "Wallace," flicking cigar ash on the rug. "I want a house with a flat roof. But how do you drain water off a flat roof?" "You use the gutters," Wallace Neff replied. "Well, that's the house for me. I came from the gutter and I'd feel at home in a place like that." Let's now turn to the home of Jane Mansfield and Mickey Hargitay, Mr. Universe. This was an 8-bedroom, 13-bathroom, Spanish colonial-style house originally built in the 1920s for Rudy Valley, and it was located on Sunset Boulevard. They purchased it in 1961 for $74,000. And the couple set about turning their new home into a Hollywood extravaganza. The house was given the nickname the Pink Palace after Jane Mansfield had painted it a soft shade of pink. And the house famously glistened and sparkled because the pink paint was mixed up with crushed sandstone. Well, the house quickly became a tourist trap. Cars and buses would slow down and stop and look at the estate and the big wrought iron gates that featured the initials JM for Jane Mansfield, centered in the signature heart shape. Well, she loved all this attention, and oftentimes she would step out on a balcony facing Sunset Boulevard to wave to all of her adoring fans. The most unusual and notable feature of the house was, without a doubt, the heart-shaped pool with the words, "I love you, Janie," spelled out in mosaics on the bottom. Now, directly behind the Pink Palace was Owlwood, another very famous and fabled estate that was once owned by Tony Curtis and then later Sonny and Cher. Across the road from the Pink Palace was the former Esther Williams estate, and tragically, Jane Mansfield was killed in an automobile accident in 1967 in Mississippi. And after Mansfield's death, the Pink Palace was reported to have been occupied at different times by Mama Cass and Ringo Starr. The estate was later purchased by Engelbert Humperdinck, and it was his residence for 17 years before selling it in 2002 to the owner of Owlwood. Well, Mansfield's beloved Pink Palace, as well as the Esther Williams home, were demolished by the owner of Owlwood in order to create a monstrous 10-acre estate for himself. Well, that is one of the purposes of historic preservation. So we've lost so many of these beautiful homes, and this is because so many of them have not been protected. Now, these houses not only are stars in their own rights because of their beautiful architecture, but oftentimes the people who lived in these homes have given it these homes a very important quality. And these buildings are disappearing, and it's very disheartening. It's important to know that you listeners can influence these houses to keep them from being razed down. There needs to be more public outcry, and only recently did the city of Beverly Hills have a small preservation ordinance, and there are many districts that are under historic zones called HPOZs, which are historic preservation overlay zones. But you know, certain properties of historical significance get torn down very quickly. So we've lost Lucille Ball's home. We, of course, just heard about the Pickfair estate being bulldozed overnight without notice. We've lost a Lautner home in Beverly Hills. We've lost many Paul Williams homes. And so if we were to landmark these homes, we could make it easier to preserve these homes. So I encourage you to get involved with organizations like the National Trust for Historic Preservation, the Los Angeles Conservancy, all of the conservation efforts wherever you may be listening from. It's important that we all raise our voices so that we don't lose so many of these historic places. And so, with that, I look forward to speaking with all of you next week. This is Dishing the Dirt on Design. I'm Eleanor Schrader Schapa. And again, please go to our Facebook page and like us. And this way, you'll be able to get updates whenever I post some new images or tell you about some upcoming events that we have, some upcoming tours that we'll be going through and taking you through some of these historic houses. So go to Facebook.com, Dishing the Dirt on Design. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you again for listening this week. Ann Asher and Eleanor Schrader Schapa will be back next Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time for another edition of Dishing the Dirt on Design on the Voice America Variety Channel. Have a great week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.